In a new book, it's called The Living Bird, 100 Years of Listening to Nature. The stunning photos capture birds, and frankly, this is the most stunning collection of bird photos that I have ever seen. It is absolutely mind-boggling. It captures the relationship, or allows you and me to explore the relationship between people and birds, and the close-ups that are in the book help us kind of understand the lives and connect us to the birds. It features over 250 photos, along with essays, wonderful essays from leading naturalists. And it was created for the 100th anniversary of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Really pleased to have Garrett Venn join us. Garrett, a photographer, cinematographer, producer for the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, leads expeditions around the world to document wildlife and conservation stories, and he goes to great lengths to capture powerful, very powerful imagery. And Garrett, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Larry. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you along. And just for our listeners, you may have a question and a comment for him. Maybe it's about the Cornell Lab. Maybe it's about birds. I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. And wildlife photography, obviously, is on Garrett's mind all the time, I'm pretty sure. And if you have questions in that area, he's probably happy to answer those as well. I've featured many, many books from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology over the years. And this is the 100th anniversary of the lab. Maybe talk about the lab itself. Give us a little history of that lab.
Okay. The lab was founded about 100 years ago by a fellow named Arthur Allen, and he was actually the first official professor of ornithology in the United States. And he set up an office in the entomology building and posted up a little sign that said Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And since that first day 100 years ago, the institution has grown into a world-class center of biodiversity science and conservation and communications. Ever since its early years with Arthur Allen, it was also an institution not just about science like many universities, but also about communicating with people, engaging the public, bringing the public into the scientific process, embracing art and music and audio recording and filming and all these other aspects and ways that you can approach birds and science. So it's kind of a 360-degree institution that looks at birds in many, many different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful, wonderful institution. We're lucky to have it. Talk about how this book celebrates that mission of connecting people to birds.
Well, it looks at birds in a number of different ways. A lot of times people hear the name ornithology and they think of bird watchers and people crashing through the bushes in bad outfits with binoculars, chasing birds around, and they think as bird watchers as people who just like to look at birds. And there's so much more to birds that not only bird watchers or scientists enjoy about birds, but things that we all benefit from by paying attention to birds. So the lab has been always about many of these other things, and this book kind of explores three overarching themes that address, why we have this fascination with birds. It delves into, in the first major essay, Scott Weinsall, who's a well-known natural history author, kind of delves into just these birds as fascinating biological creatures, all these amazing things we're discovering about birds every day that they can do. And then there's another chapter by a woman writer named Leanda Lynn Haupt, who lives out here in Seattle, and she explores a lot of the more intangible benefits we get from birds, how they make us feel, how they enrich our lives, how they bring people into the scientific process. So she explores a whole bunch of different of those type of areas. And then the director of the lab, John Fitzpatrick, delves into this larger idea that looking at birds gives us a whole tremendous lens and new way of looking at the environment around us. Birds are, our most visible companions on this planet, and people like to watch them and measure them and count them. So it gives us a great way to look at the underlying ecological fabric of our landscapes, and by looking at birds, we can monitor the health of our landscapes, and they often tip us off to, an early warning sign when things aren't going right. So it kind of explores those three big themes that really have a zillion ways you can look at birds that kind of answer those questions.
And I love those essays. They're so well written. And I learned so much. I learned something in every one of them. And along with your stunning photography, oh my God. And you didn't mention Barbara Kingsolver.
Yeah, well, Barbara wrote the foreword for the book.
Yes.
When we invited her to write that, I had no idea the well of personal experience she had to draw on to create such. I mean, really, it goes through her whole life and her relationship with birds and how it changed through time, through different relationships with people in her family, and what it meant to different people in her life. And it's just a really incredible essay. Just beautiful piece.
It is a beautiful piece, and I read that first, and I thought, boy, I hope the rest of the essays can stand up to that one, and indeed they do, for sure, but it was a rousing way to start, that's for sure.
Yeah, we were really lucky to get such a great group of writers to work on this project and to articulate so many of these things that we love about birds.
And your photography, it is the most stunning collection I have seen in one book. It is, you are a fabulous photographer.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And you've got one of the, I think, one of the amazing jobs that probably a lot of people in the world would like to have as part of your job anyway. You get to lead tours around the world to look at birds.
Yeah, well, I don't so much lead tours as I travel around the world working on film projects, photography projects, to explore some different conservation issues affecting birds around the world for the most part. So that's kind of the focus of my work, working on a variety of different critically endangered species around the world and trying to put together their stories to connect people with some of these larger ecological problems that these species are telling us about.
Yeah, you have photos and a story about one of the most endangered species in the world, I think is how you pronounced it. Or mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we call it the most imperiled species.
Imperiled species, I'm sorry.
That's the spoon-billed sandpiper. So I don't know how familiar you are with bird watching or birds, but this is a bird that's kind of one of those holy grail birds for bird watchers around the world. It's, if you ask 10 bird watchers what bird would they most like to see, probably more than half would say a spoon-billed sandpiper. And it's a little shorebird. For people who don't know birds very well, there's another small sandpiper called the sanderling, and that's the little shorebird you see chasing waves on the beach, which you might see in Lake Michigan shorelines there during migration.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another little bird like that called the spoon-billed sandpiper that lives in remote areas of Chukotka in the summer, where it breeds in the far east of Russia. And it winters in Southeast Asia and southern China and some of these places. And the areas that they need to make their long-distance migrations are rapidly being changed from mudflats and places where these birds can feed into industrial use and other land uses in China and South Korea. And this bird is really representative of a whole flyway of species whose numbers are drastically declining because of the just incredibly rapid pace of development happening in that part of the world.
It's something. Randy, and I have some callers online with questions about birds. Let's turn first to Randy in La Crosse. Randy, hi. Sure. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes, nice to talk to you. My concern is about the tundra swan migration. I've followed this migration for many years. I'm 63 years old. My wife and I have been watching for over 30 years. But anyway, down in Pool 8, below Brownsville, Minnesota, is where the swans have discovered this area probably 25 or 30 years ago, mm-hmm. when the Alma site kind of weeded in and, silted up, and they have no more to eat. But I was wondering if anybody could tell me why there's so much wild rice in the areas where these birds come to feed before their last phase of the migration to the Chesapeake area. It doesn't seem like they can eat wild rice, and the whole Pool 8 is full of wild rice, and it's displaced the tuber aquatic vegetation that these birds feed on. I was wondering if anybody from the conservation department or you folks would know anything about that.
That's probably a tough one for you.
Yep. I don't know about the local conditions there. Is that something you know anything about, Larry?
Not something I could really comment on, but migrations, let's talk about migrations, because you certainly cover migrations in your book.
Yeah. Yeah, and one thing about tundra swans, I know many of these swan species, I don't know if this is the situation there, but during the afternoon and at night, they'll roost in aquatic areas, but during the day, they'll spread out over farm fields and eat some of the waste grain and the root systems of different things like corn. So I don't know if these birds may be dispersing during the day to other feeding areas and then roosting at night in some of these marshes, if that might be a possibility.
That could be. That's probably is a pretty good possibility. Thanks, Randy, for calling. Janet in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, guys. Just kind of a fun story, your conversation about people's interest and the effect birds have on people and migration all inspired me to call in and let you know that my sister had been stressing last week. She's had a hummingbird at her feeder all week. And so we decided to do a little investigation, and long story short, it turned out that this is an unusual hummingbird. It's not a ruby-throated, which is common to our area. It's called the Anna's hummingbird, which looks really similar, and you need kind of an expert, I guess, to really determine that it's an Anna's. So we had someone come out that did capture the bird and ID'd it and banded it. And it's just been really exciting. So now she's had lots of interested folks traipsing through her yard with, you know, lenses longer than your car. And it's been really fun to watch. And we've learned so much more about them, too, that they can withstand temperatures below zero, which is a small comfort given the time of year that we're viewing her. And we're not sure how long she'll stay, but it's kind of fun. I understand that she's the seventh to ever have been found or seen in Wisconsin.
Oh, very cool, Janet. Thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, that's a neat bird. We have those in Seattle here, and historically they migrated farther south in the winter, but because we have a milder climate here in the lowlands in the winter, and there are so many people with hummingbird feeders that most of these Anna's hummingbirds now spend the winter much farther north than they did historically.
Yeah, very, very cool. Jesse in Madison has a question. Hi, Jesse. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you. Just a real quick question. If someone, basically, I'm an avid hunter fisherman, I always am seeing cool things in the woods. I've been videoing stuff for years now, and I want to start capturing stuff in still frames. So I want to know if you've got any suggestions for a good and expensive starter camera, and I'll take your answer off air. Thanks again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't kept up much with the kind of the consumer level camera technology, but you know, an entry level or mid level Nikon or Canon DSLR that has a decent frame rate, probably what he might like to get is one of these cameras that has a crop frame sensor, so he'll get a little more reach off a less expensive lens. A lot of guys just getting into shooting some wildlife and nature, if he wants to shoot deer and stuff, kind of a versatile, less expensive lens. It's a 100 to 400 zoom, mm-hmm. that Canon and Nikon both make one.
And that's we'll take that up and talk a little bit more about cameras right after a look at the news. Stay with us. There are a few things that convey a sense of place, of time of day, end of season, more than the comings and goings of birds. And to get an even closer look at their lives, I hope you'll take a look at a new book. It's called The Living Bird, 100 Years of Listening to Nature. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. The book was created for the 100th year anniversary of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And we're visiting today. Our guest is Garrett Vinn, a photographer, cinematographer, producer for the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He has documented wildlife and conservation stories around the world, and his photos, just absolutely stunning photos, more than 250 of them appear in the book, it's really some powerful imagery. And again, Garrett, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our caller just before our news break asked about starter photography. What kinds of equipment do you use? What are your cameras?
I use some stuff from both Nikon and Canon systems. Both companies have offer some different things that the other company doesn't yet as far as advancements in technology. The work that I do, we try to keep the level, you know, right at the cutting edge as far as the quality of image goes in the cinematography, and that sometimes dictates what type of camera I'm using for still photography. So I've got a number of different, DSLR 35 millimeter camera bodies, and then, a whole selection of different lenses ranging from 800 millimeter, 600 millimeter, all the way to wide angle lenses like a 14 millimeter lens. Your basic big lens like you see on the field of a sporting event kind of thing.
Oh, and just as an aside, digital photography must have just sort of revolutionized your way of photography.
Well, it certainly has changed photography and made it much more accessible to many more people. It's amazing, 20-some years ago when I got really serious about my photography, you could go just about anywhere other than the Everglades in Florida or Yellowstone and not see another guy out there with a big lens. Now you see them all over the place. You don't have to buy film anymore, so that makes it easier for people to once they've made the investment in some camera equipment, their investment's over for a while. They don't have to keep buying and developing film and managing all those slides. So it's become a lot more easy for people, and then a lot more fun too, because with the internet, people are able to share them and show their friends and family, and it's not just a bunch of slides in a file cabinet somewhere that never see the light of day.
Yeah.
So it's really definitely changed. The technology's changed with the autofocus systems that have come along around the same time as digital was taking off. The autofocus systems got a lot better, so that took a lot of the skill out of a technical skill that you needed to really consistently make sharp images. It lowered made people much more able to take sharp images and to take images of action and flight and all these things that were very difficult before those systems were as good as they are today.
Yeah. Well, your photos are absolutely stunning, and I'm amazed every time I open the book and look at them and look at them again. And I wondered let me rephrase this a bit. Is it necessary to know a lot about birds to be able to take photos like you take them?
I think so, yeah, I do. I think that's, I often get that question of what would be your advice to somebody starting out? And to me, that the first thing that you can do to become a better photographer is to know more about birds. I think having intimate knowledge of different species through observation and reading about them and gives you a much clearer understanding of where they should be, what they should look like, what behaviors they might do, and also what's acceptable behavior when you're out there taking photographs of birds. You do run into some people these days that don't know very little about birds, and they're out there taking bird photos and not doing the kind of things that most people would want to do as far as disturbing birds or flushing birds. So it's to me, it's the most important first step, is to really have a good understanding of bird behavior and knowing about the birds, caring about the birds. I think that comes through in the photography.
Yeah, it surely does. And I get some of these photos. Your camouflage photos, I was trying to remember, was it a red knot?
Yeah, there is a red knot in the book. I think a nest with some chicks in it from kind of overhead in the lichens. Yeah, red knot. That's a tundra nesting shorebird that lives up in the Arctic.
And you really have to look at that photo. I found it. I opened it up. It's on page 34 of your book. You look at that photo, and it takes a while to pick out those birds. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, the way that some of these birds disappear. There's another bird called a red phalarope later on in the book that I photographed in the same way from overhead. It's also a ground-nesting tundra bird. And I have some video of that same moment when the bird is kind of walking and getting onto its nest. And as it's moving, you can see it very clearly. It's actually quite brightly colored on its sides. But as it nestles into its nest and then becomes still, it just vanishes into the landscape. And that's so all of these aerial predators that you have on the tundra, like different species of gulls and jaegers that spend much of the summer flying around and looking down at the ground for eggs and chicks to eat, keeps them concealed from those predators.
There are several sections in the book that you wrote, in addition to having the photography in the book. There's a section titled In the Field where you talk about some of your adventures, and you wrote one called Among Flamingos, and talk about your trip to Mexico with some beautiful close-ups.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of work in the last few years, and I think I'll be continuing to do some work down in a place called the Rio Lagartos Biosphere Reserve, which is on the Yucatan in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a major flamingo colony there that was in very low numbers and has been protected now, and they're flourishing. And working with some partners down there who are working with local communities to conserve the bird, we're working on some media outreach pieces for them to continue their conservation efforts there to protect these birds. And I think I wrote in that article or that little essay a bit about, you know, I had never really paid any attention to flamingos in my life up until being sent on this assignment. They were just kind of these things you saw in zoos, and, you know, they kind of don't even seem like birds anymore because they're mm-hmm. kind of cliche mm-hmm. animals in some way. But I tell you, the first evening that I slithered out into the mud near this flamingo colony and had all of these flamingos around me, it was just an absolutely amazing experience. They are incredible birds to see in the wild.
They really are beautiful. And as I looked at those photos, I thought, I wonder if he's ever had a chance to photo or shoot photos of the scarlet ibis. I spent time in Trinidad and Tobago, and so I had an opportunity to see the scarlet ibis in the wild, and it's a stunning, stunning a fluorescent scarlet color.
Yes, I haven't seen that yet, but that's the place to go if you want to see that bird. But yeah, I'd love to see those someday.
Oh man, they're and a really interesting bird as well. Well, interesting, the flamingos. How did it change your view of flamingos? You said it was an interesting bird, or you learned a lot from watching them.
Yeah, it's like one of those birds, like a peacock or a flamingo, that, you know, you've seen your whole life in zoos or plastic lawn ornaments, and that somehow they become not birds anymore. They
yeah.
become kind of a, I don't know what the word would be. But, you know, experiencing them where they actually belong in their own environment and watching the things that they do and they're specialized to do, you know, these incredibly long necks and legs, and they're filter feeders, so they use these beaks to strain tiny organisms out of these hypersaline wetlands. And they're very serene animals, and, you know, they march around, and they have these enormous colonies. The colony that I was shooting, there were 17,000 chicks all in one flock in the colony.
Wow.
And it's really interesting how they kind of communally raise their chicks, and they're very social, and their interactions, and they're just fascinating to watch, and just you know, when you really look at how a flamingo is built, the colors and the shape and the these incredible long legs, and it's just amazing. They're amazing creatures, you know. They're just, they're like nothing else.
Yeah, and just in terms of habits and stuff, the section on this, the piece on the secret lives, life of birds, I think is what was the title of it. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, there are so many things about birds that if you, you know, when you go out and watch birds, it's one thing to look at beautiful birds, but when you know many of the things about their physiology or their behavior or their migrations, or there's just countless things that if you know these things about them and then look at them, they become even, you know, something entirely different. You know, to really understand some of these things just makes birds just a looking glass into all these miracles of nature that are all around us every day, you know.
Can you pick a behavior of a bird that that might be something that people haven't considered or thought about or seen or learned about?
Mm-hmm. Well, one group of birds that's another just fascinating group of birds to watch, which you have some in Minnesota. I know that there's a few prairie chickens left in Minnesota, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I know that over in western Wisconsin, there's a few last vestiges of the greater prairie chicken populations, which have dwindled throughout the prairie regions of our country. If you go a little farther west, and you'll see more of them in the Dakotas and Nebraska. But this prairie chickens and a number of other grouse species are these birds that each spring, you know, for much of the year they're cryptic and they're not very visible, but each spring the males of these species will all gather together in a traditional place, could have been maybe used for thousands of years, and their plumage transforms and they do these displays and calls, and all these males are doing this while at the same time fighting with each other for little spaces on this location, which is called a lek. And they'll do this for 2 or 3 months every morning in the spring. And females will come, kind of walk through, take a look at the males, and there's some subtle thing about their displays in which the females decide that's the one I like and that's the one I'm going to mate with. And it's an absolutely fascinating behavior. They're beautiful. And it's something you can watch in many places. I think probably in Minnesota there may be a public viewing blind where you can go and watch this.
Yeah, in Wisconsin we do have a viewing blind, or blinds I should say, and it really is something to behold. I think you talked about that. You had another bird. Oh gosh, now it just flew out of my head. A duck, a merganser, I believe. You talked about the sort of the courtship of and what mergansers do with preening and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, many of these duck species, and Wisconsin obviously is a tremendous state for ducks and waterfowl. Many duck species, males have this beautiful plumage, and the females are quite drab. And it's during the winter months when they're in places like Wisconsin, when the males are displaying and the females are choosing which male that they're going to head back north with and mate with. So you can see a lot of these birds like hooded mergansers or common golden eyes, or many of these birds that do, the males kind of get in groups on the lake and display. They'll throw their head back and give different calls or do a variety of different maneuvers depending on the species. But they're also, you know, very beautiful birds to watch. Close at hand there in Wisconsin.
It's, for me, one of the most fun times of the year was in living in Madison. We have several lakes, and I live next to a lake, and watching, having the chance to see the migrations of mergansers and every other bird, every other duck, is just absolutely amazing. And the loons. We might have 100 loons on Lake Monona at one time, on their way north or on their way south, and it's really a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's also, you know, the waterfowl are a testament to what we can do when we realize that we've damaged a group of birds or the environment in some way. Back 70, 800 years ago, the wood duck, for example, was predicted to be the next species to go extinct after the passenger pigeon because so many waterfowl species were just being decimated by market hunting. And around that time, that was recognized by us. We passed new laws to protect some of these species and to start preserving wetlands and restoring wetlands. And the populations of many duck species today are greater than they've ever been because we took action. And you know, it's provided a great resource for people and been a great success as far as conservation goes.
Sylvia in Appleton has a comment, so let's go to her next. Sylvia, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to compliment Garrett. I recognize his name from I'm a member of the Cornell, and The Living Bird is also a magazine. I have not seen the book yet.
You're in for a treat.
Some of his pictures in The Living Bird magazine are just terrific. They're fantastic. So
thank
I
you.
Just wanted to call in and compliment him on doing a very nice job with these.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank Sylvia, wait till you see the book. How did you ever select? I mean, oh, there are, it must have been quite a process putting this book together. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it was. We kind of had to do it on a short timeline the way things worked out. But I had the publisher here in Seattle, Mountaineers Books, that published it is just a tremendous group of people. And they do all sorts of books related to the environment, hiking, canoeing, outdoor pursuits. And they also do, you know, nature, natural history, and conservation books. So they're a great partner for us to work on this book with. They have a lot of other super cool books out there. But they, you know, they shepherded the whole process, and they helped me be ruthless, and they were ruthless at times with selecting what photos to put in the book. So, yeah, it's definitely a hard process to whittle it down. There's so many criteria you're kind of taking into account, you know, as far as what kind of diversity do we want in the book. Different colors, different feelings, different stories behind the birds. So, yeah, it was a long process to pick them out.
We had a call earlier who said, I saw 22 eagles around Lynxville, just an amazing sight in one little afternoon, and you've got three wonderful eagle photos in the book as well.
Yeah, another great example of a bird as an indicator of something wrong in the environment. Bald eagles were decimated by DDT back in the 70s, as were a number of other species. And we recognized that, banned the use of that chemical in North America, and that bird has made a tremendous recovery. They're actually quite common throughout large portions of the lower 48 now. I actually saw one just about an hour ago driving into the studio here.
Very cool. And the I guess one of the reasons you want to document this and one of the reasons for the book, in addition to sort of celebrating the 100 years of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, is to sort of clue people into some of the benefits and some of the things that that our birds can do for us. I think documenting what's happening environmentally through our birds is something that you feature in the book.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that the Cornell Lab really pays attention to, and we have a number of citizen science programs that involve the public in that work. One of them, which I'm sure many of your listeners listening may use, eBird,
yep.
Which is a program where people who are out bird watching and looking at birds can report their sightings in checklists. And some people submit thousands of checklists every year. And right now we're taking in over 1 million checklists per day. And that kind of data collection overlaid with other types of data that we know about the environment is just revolutionizing the way we're able to look at bird distributions and movements. And because of that, we're able to look at the underlying environmental health for many of these places they depend on. So it's really exciting, revolutionary way that citizens, regular people, are actually out there collecting the data, allowing us to really monitor the health of the environment around us.
Fascinating. And a fascinating book. How's it doing? I hope it's doing well. Of course, it hasn't been out very long.
Yeah, it hasn't been out very long. From what I hear, it's doing great so far, which is exciting. You know, it's a book that, bird people will really enjoy it, but I think it's also a great entree book for people who may have a passive interest in nature or the outdoors. We wanted it to be a book that could be for everybody and really help people who haven't yet discovered or really been hooked by birds to understand why so many people care about birds so much and watch birds. So anyone who's got someone in their life they think or might want a light bulb moment with the world around them and what birds do for people's lives once they stop to look and listen, I highly recommend it as a gift.
Yeah, well, I have a 12-year-old daughter at home, and I'm really looking forward to bringing this book home for her to see and to read the pieces. I know she's going to like it, and she's old enough, and I think if you're 12 or 100, you're going to enjoy this book. Thank you so much, Garrett, for taking time to be with us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Larry.
Garrett Venn is the photographer for the book The Living Bird, 100 Years of Listening to Nature. He's a producer for the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and this is really a fascinating and just stunning, stunning book. I hope you get a chance to see it. It's really worth a look. We have a link to it on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and of course at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about pierogi love, new takes on an old world comfort food, and then some travel advice from Rick Seney of faircompare.com. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.